We have a monopoly problem that threatens our well-being as consumers, as workers, and as citizens. You know, and big tech is a major part of this, and it's a threat to our democracy. It is brute, open use of power in the Republican administration. The only people who still believe in this nonsense ideology are the elites in the, or half the elites in the Democratic Party. They essentially sold off American democracy for $1 billion, which they then wasted. They wasted by giving it all back to Facebook as we clean the party of the people who are too corrupt or too stupid. Then we will find ourselves with an institution that we can use to bust this power, to retake control and bust this power.
How do we remove them? Is the $1 billion question.
Welcome to Radius of Reason, a podcast about the greatest problems facing humanity. I'm Levon, here with my co-host, Andre.
On previous episodes, we've discussed the threat posed by unchecked neoliberal economics. To continue this conversation, we're joined today by Barry Lynn, the executive director of the Open Markets Institute. This is a think tank that studies monopolies and their impact on government, the economy, as well as society.
We spoke to Barry about how corporate power undermines democracy and what can be done to resolve this issue.
Barry, we hear a lot lately in the news about the brilliance of Silicon Valley, the wonderful contributions they make to our country, to our planet. And the refrain that is often repeated is that anytime the government gets involved in the workings of tech, anytime any form of regulation is introduced into the picture, that it's inhibiting the genius of Silicon Valley, of the business-minded. What are your reactions to that?
Well, I understand why they believe that, but nobody else should believe that. Every good thing that has come technologically to the American people, to the people of the world, you know, is due to having smart rule of law, smart regulations on technologies. Smart regulations on the power of the people that control the giant corporations. Fair, safe parameters. It should never, ever block a good idea. In fact, there's no history. Nobody can say in the past there was a better idea that was blocked by good regulation. You know, it's good regulation makes better ideas possible. You know, and actually one of the ways that regulation makes better ideas possible is by protecting the innovator from super large corporations. Mm-hmm. That's what patent law is. That's what copyright law is. That's in the Constitution. And so in the Constitution, you have laws that promote monopoly for the individual, precisely to protect the individual from the power of the large corporation. So there's layer upon layer upon layer of ideas, of law out there that is designed to make it easier to bring better ideas to market and to build those ideas into real corporations that serve people. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. Mr. Musk. So Mr. Musk spent most of his life building great things. He built rockets, and he built...
Well, technically, the Soviets built the rockets.
That's true. Yeah, he was not out there. He was sleeping on the floor, but he was providing the frameworks from which the engineers and the manufacturing employees could actually build these rockets and build these cars and build these new satellite systems. Really brilliant, important new services. And then, because we didn't enforce basic laws about sort of vertical integration, he ended up owning X, owning Twitter. And, since that moment, he should never have been allowed to own Twitter. There's actually traditional American laws that would prohibit that kind of integration between different communications platforms. Mm-hmm. And the dude has, gone whack. It's like suddenly he's like, I am the master of your mind, right? So it's like, you know what? If we had just kept him on the straight and narrow, building rockets, building cars, building tunnels, he would still be a good guy.
we would have saved Elon Musk. Yeah.
That's the real tragedy of all this.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying this episode, just a quick reminder to like and subscribe.
And we'd love to keep the conversation going with you. Let us know in the comments section if you think big tech should be regulated.
Regulation, actually, what it does is, one way to look at it, it actually protects you from your own appetite. You know, the people who are enormously successful or enormously brilliant, a lot of these people are quite brilliant. And it's like, regulation protects you from your appetite.
From your own impulses.
Just dominate, yeah. So you have to serve rather than dominate.
I mean, you mentioned that there was like a framework in place that should have prevented this from happening. Okay. The acquisition of X. Okay, the framework was there, but why was it not enforced? How do we get to this point in maybe our legal system, in our government, that these sorts of authorities are not implemented when they should be?
Yeah, and that's a great question, because it's like, how did this disaster happen? You know, and our organization, Open Markets, back in November 2022, we actually put together a letter to the a number of the agencies in the U.S. government, the FTC, the DOJ, the FCC, CFPB, SEC, CFIUS. Saying, hey, all of you have some concerns, should have some concerns about this deal. Mm-hmm. And there is a number of existing sort of authorities that you have that you can begin to use to protect the people who will be affected by this deal. And this is actually, you know, maybe you think this deal is a little bit in a vague zone, but, you know, because it's different than anything you've seen before. Give yourself time to go back and relearn the purpose of the law. You guys are all new to your jobs. We haven't done in America. We haven't done this kind of regulation well in 40 years because we've had this neoliberal governing idea, this libertarian laissez-faire, let the rich do whatever the hell they want, governing idea, mm-hmm. which is controlled Democrats and Republicans. And so take some time, relearn your laws. And, the FCC, especially the Federal Communications Commission, especially had authorities that would have allowed them to say, you know what, we already have licensed you to run a communications corporation, which is called Starlink. It's a internet in space, Starlink. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are laws that basically, in their traditions, there are models, regulatory models in the United States, say if you control a platform like Starlink, you can't also control a communications platform, a second one. So we're going to stop you from owning two, both Starlink and X or Twitter. So that was, but there were many other potential laws. So why didn't this happen? It was partly because, after 40 years of this kind of nonsense idea of this, let markets be markets, let the rich people do what rich people do because they're so wise. even like this fantastic team of people who are in the Biden administration, my friends. Even my friends, this smartest crew of regulators, of enforcers, law enforcers, in the last, in 50 years, weren't really up to speed on their own authorities. Hmm.
Interesting. So, I mean, you mentioned laissez-faire economics. You mentioned kind of a culture of 40 to 50 years of us just kind of letting the rich do what they will. What is your kind of diagnosis as to what's that resulted in? If you had to take stock of where our country, where our planet is today, what has that kind of approach to regulating or maybe avoiding regulation done to our environment, our ecosystem, our friends?
Yeah. it's actually pretty easy to answer that. We're, authoritarianism, concentration of all, and most of the power of communications in the hands of like a few corporations, a few men. The merger together of that power over all communications with the state, as Trump sort of forces these corporations to do, do his bidding, mm-hmm. and vice versa, as they force him to do their bidding. Mm-hmm. So it's this merger of state and private power over communications, over information, over what we see, what we read, what we listen to, what entertainment choose, what books we read, and what we see, the 50 years ago, if you go back, to the late early 1980s, America was still very much an economic democracy. Power was distributed every place. There was, you had no power, no corporations of nearly of the power and control that you see today in any sector. And those corporations that control communications were entirely neutralized. They were not allowed to get in your head. They were not allowed to manipulate how you spoke to other people. You jump ahead to today and you see all power concentrated increasingly in the hands of 4, 5, 6 corporations, 4, 5, 6 people in the hands of the state. And that's a direct outcome of this radical laissez-faire experiment that we engaged in, that we embraced, in the early 80s.
Which came first? Was it the weakness of the government, which allowed the corporations to gain power, or was it they utilized the power that they had to weaken the government? Like, what, they flourished because of a weak government, or they created a weak government?
It was actually an intellectual revolution. That's what makes it sort of fascinating, is that it was a decision by people who, our government that we established in the late 18th century, in the Constitution, and then sort of everything that we built atop the Constitution is a very powerful government. And it was designed to control corporations. The first 100 years of the United States, from 1776 until 1876, there were no corporations as we know them today. Mm-hmm. There were corporations, but they were entirely controlled by the legislatures of individual states or the Congress of the United States. They were intimately regulated. Then the modern corporation begins after the Civil War. But even so, for the next 100 years, you had all of these incredibly powerful laws to regulate the use of corporations. It was antitrust and the Interstate Commerce Act, which absolutely regulated how communications platforms were able to operate. Incredibly power. And the purpose of this was not to have the state in control. It was actually to prevent concentration of power by anybody. Mm-hmm. Democratic governance over corporations to ensure the liberty of the individual. That was what we had. And that allowed us to, over time, to make our country a better place. By allowing more and more people to claim liberty for themselves, to mm-hmm. fight for liberty for themselves. Originally it was just for upper class white men, and then lower class white men said us too, and then black men said us too, and then women said us too, and then so you had this fight, and so by the 50 years ago, we had gone this incredible period of technological advance and moral advance and unprecedented in American history. And then we, at the top of the world, when we could have actually gone to doing things like eliminating hydrocarbons and making it and feeding the people of the world, we said, you know what, let's make the rich richer. And so how did they do that? They said, they came up with this ideology of radical laissez-faire, neoliberalism, they targeted competition policy. They targeted our antitrust laws and the laws that we use to regulate communications. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get rid of the anti-monopoly laws and let create new monopolists who will be able to concentrate wealth and power in the hands of the few.
So they repealed certain anti-monopoly laws, but you said there's still traditional laws in place that would have kept, for example,
Elon Musk and X.
Acquiring X. So what else accounts for that weakness and application of the existing law?
They actually didn't repeal a damn law, not one law.
Oh,
okay. What they did, that they said is, okay, we've been looking at this law. There's a whole body of laws. There's the Constitution, and then we've built hundreds of laws on top of that to regulate the power of corporations, monopolies, to prevent monopolies. And the purpose. So for 200 years, we said the purpose of these laws is to protect the liberty of the individual, to protect our democracy, to protect innovation. And then when Robert Bork, he was and Richard Posner and the other sort of neoliberals, the fathers of the neoliberal movement, when they came along in the late 70s and early 80s, they said, you know what, though, that approach to regulation is wasteful. It's getting in the way of powerful people, of corporations, their ability to make more stuff for you. Mm-hmm. We're preventing them from making cheaper chickens. We're preventing them from making cheaper cars, which that claim itself was bogus because actually cost is shaped by competition. But they made an argument that greater scale and scope would result in lower cost products and services. And so they said, let's change the purpose of the law. Let's see how let's say this. The purpose of the law is not to protect the independence and liberty of the citizen. We're going to use these laws to promote the material well-being of the consumer. And so the whole body of law was governed by this idea of the well-being of the citizen. And they pulled out the word citizen and they replaced it with the word consumer. And then the next day people woke up and the laws looked different. If you look at it through the lens of citizenship, the laws look one way. If you look at it through the lens of consumer, they look a different way. So they didn't actually change the law. That was the fundamental brilliance of the neoliberal movement was, we're going to change the way you see the law. We're not going to change the letter of the law. And so that's why, and this is one of the great achievements of the Biden administration. President Biden himself, in July of 2021, 4 years ago, went out and said, this approach, this neoliberal approach to law, resulted in a political and economic disaster in America, and we are getting rid of this. We're going back to our traditional reading of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so so we're partly awakened to, in America, we have actually partly awakened to the disasters. Actions or of that previous generation, but we still have a ways to go.
I mean, but then how would you how do you think about the rejection of those Biden administration policies, like the disastrous performance of Democrats in the previous round of elections? Was that not a damning of that kind of position by the American voter?
American voters didn't really know anything about that, right? Biden was the most important president. If you actually look at his actions on power, he was he focused more on the power of the corporation than any president since Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. Hmm. And he had incredible successes. He had successes in terms of changing the philosophy of the law. And in terms of actually enforcing the law, and then when his team went to market, when they went to the campaign, when they went to campaign for re-election in 2024, they didn't talk about their successes.
What was the reason for that? I mean, and again, in the context of like the messaging coming from the Trump campaign, the messaging coming from the Bernie Sanders campaign. For the two times he ran in 2016 and 2020, it seems like that's such a no-brainer. Highlight the bona fide credibility you have as a check on corporate power, which I think is the appetite that so many Americans have right now.
Yeah, and I think there's probably there's a two-step answer to that. First step is under Biden. His team, you know, they just really weren't very energetic. We worked very closely with the White House, and we kept saying, guys, just get your you know, I mean, very politely, we were basically saying, get your shit together. You know,
it's like, I don't know if there's a polite way to say that.
You know, but, yeah. But it's, you know, it's like, you got this amazing, you have an amazing story. You have a set of victories. You have reversed 40 plus years of pro-monopoly, pro-autocracy policy. You're making people freer. You're making people wealthier. And go out and claim that, own that, and then tell people what are the other targets that you need to take down, the other enemies of people's liberty and well-being. Because you're going to take this in this next 4 years, you're going after the hospital corporations, and you're going to go after the drug corporations, and you're going to go about, you're going to finish the job of fixing big tech, so that they're not meddling and manipulating your life and the lives of your children. You're going to do all these things to make people's, you're going to restore democracy and liberty in the United States. You can do that. You are doing that. So talk about it. And they didn't. And then when he handed the baton over to Vice President Harris, she was given that opportunity to own what the Biden people had done.
Specifically the work of the FTC under Biden.
Specifically the work of the FTC. And Reid Hoffman, the found, you know, a very, very rich man, a man who actually, you know, is trying in various ways, actually wants to see democracy, the founder of LinkedIn, gave the vice president a softball. He said, well, the first thing you need to do is fire Lina Khan, who's the head of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. And that's a softball. Now, he may not have intended it as a softball. That's a softball. You just like, you whack that out of the park. You say, absolutely not. I am 100% behind Lina Khan, because Lina Khan is fighting for the American people. She's making people freer, and she is making people more well. She's fighting the evilest, nastiest, biggest people in this world for you. For you, the voter. And she ain't done yet, because these people had 40 years to concentrate power over you and your family and your community. And we ain't done yet. And we're going to go and finish this goddamn job. She could have said that. But her people told her not to do that. So what was the result? Why did they do that? They wanted to bank that the money that was going to come from those Silicon Valley billionaire funders of the campaign. So they sold off. They essentially sold off American democracy for $1 billion, which they then wasted. They wasted by giving it all back to Facebook and legacy media.
They also ran some ads in Vegas on the Sphere.
That's right.
Which I think was a pretty big waste.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like they wasted the damn money. And then actually the machine that runs that is at the heart of the Democratic Party, you know, pocketed a lot of that money. So it's those are you know, the people who run the communications system for the party. They pocketed a lot of that money.
If you had to kind of earmark the greatest offenses of the Biden administration against business, by offenses, I mean what enforcements they didn't manage to move through in their 4 years. If you had to list out maybe top three accomplishments that they did that we could point to say that, yeah, this was like a seismic shift in thought, what would you point to?
Well, one of the most important is actually going after Google and ad tech. You know, it's like, so that was a shot. That was the Department of Justice said, we're going to go after Google's control over advertising, because Google with, you know, with Facebook as their kind of outrigger, have basically captured most of the control over most of the advertising online. Advertising in the United States, advertising in America, advertising in England and America, going back 400 years, is what has powered the free press. Mm-hmm. Newspapers, every real newspaper over the last 400 years was to some extent powered by advertising. Radio and broadcast and magazines, all powered largely by advertising. And it's like, you know, there's some problems with commercial advertising, but the thing is that it powered, enabled. I'm a journalist. I spent, I was a foreign correspondent. I have worked for magazines. I've worked for newspapers. I understand. I have edited a magazine. helped to pay for a magazine. So I make a magazine function in the market. So I know how advertising works. And so Google basically, by monopolizing all this advertising revenue, they starved the press. I mean, it was happening in the, right in front of our eyes. All this money, you know, billions, tens of billions, more than $100 billion a year that was going out to support publications all around the country. They just took and they put it in their own vaults. They exploited their intermediary position. So the DOJ said, we're going to go after that because that is one of the core problems of today's, of the threat to the American people today. We have to break Google's control over advertising. And so that, you know, they did. They won that case. So that would be number one. Number two, FTC went after non-competes. The non-compete laws are basically, these are millions and millions of American people. Both rich people or well-off people, engineers and doctors, but also people who work at the McDonald's or work at the at Arby's or they sign employment contracts that prevent them from looking for a new job. I mean, it's just unbelievable. In America, you have millions of people who are prohibited by contract from looking for a new job. That's the reality that we live in today. And you know, that's a type of indenturedness that exists today in America. And so the FTC under Lena Khan said, we're going to bust that. And they passed a ban to say, you guys, it's like this kind of indentured servitude in America is illegal and shall not stand. That was done by Biden. And then, you know, the third thing is actually going out and saying, this idea, this idiot idea, that has governed our brains, the brains of conservatives, the brains of liberals for the last 40 years, that the best way to go forward is to just give all power to the corporation and all power to the richest people, and they will somehow do the right thing for us. That's an idiot idea, and we are getting rid of that idiot idea. The president of the United States said essentially that in July of 2021. You guys, anybody can look it up. You're free to look it up. So those are three things, going after the heart of the problem of communications in the 21st century, Google's control over ads, going after the power that corporations have over the freedom of individuals, and going after the idea that has enslaved us all to sort of and I use the word enslavement really carefully. This is not something you should use, but it's like the idea that has enthralled us to power.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. So in the past, we had laws that were aimed at preventing concentrations of power. They didn't work. And now your goal is to enact more laws to prevent concentration of power. Like, why would it work this time?
Yeah, it's reasonable for you to ask that. That's it's a good question. But the thing is, they actually did work in the past. You know, so they if you go back over the first 200 years in the United States, there was one period when corporations escaped our control, and that was in the Gilded Age. That was the first decade of the 1900s was probably the worst the concentration of power that we saw. And then, at the end of that decade, we had a giant debate about power, about the corporation, the role of the corporation in the United States. And you had one president, Teddy Roosevelt, who kind of like Trump said, oh, what we should do is we should merge the power of the state and the private corporation.
I think Mussolini also said that.
Yeah, exactly. Teddy Roosevelt, in many ways, was the father of Mussolini and of Trump.
Oh, Christ. Okay, hot take.
But then you had this other group of people who said, no, this is radically wrong. We need to break power. We need to actually learn how to use these new laws that we've created to break power. And so they, in 1913, 1914, in a very short period of time between when the Wilson administration with Louis Brandeis as their primary power advisor, when they took power in 14 months until the beginning of the war in Europe in the summer of 1914, they passed the laws that established the foundations of modern of the industrial democracy in the United States in the for the 20th century. So basically from 1776 until 1981, with the exception of about 20 years, we had their corporations did not control the government. They had sway, they had power, but nothing like today. And people had real opportunity, real freedom to form unions, to actually create businesses and grow businesses, independent businesses, to go be a farmer if you want on 160 acres, you know. And it's like you didn't have to own half of Nebraska to survive as a farmer, you know. So it's like we have forgotten what democracy looks like and what economic democracy looks like. We had it for 200 goddamn years and we have lost it. And now one of the things is like, just go remember what it looked like and don't let anyone tell you that the past was a terrible place. It's like, so, yeah, there were bad things in the past, but there were a lot of, you know, and when it came to the distribution of power, we were so much smarter.
So 200 years, I mean, that's actually pretty good that, those laws were impactful for that time period. I think there's maybe one issue that I see is that it takes time for corporations to gain power. It takes time for them to grow. And then, you know, because of economies of scale and the fact that there is value in that, right? I mean, there's some value to the consumer. And there's, especially in terms of big tech, I mean, there's enormous value to the consumer in terms of Google Maps having more traffic data. So it gives you better, you know, predictions and so on. So I think, I think it's inevitable that you're going to, over time, see those concentrations of power. And so when the real test came, it just, you know, the laws kind of folded, right? I mean, they didn't change, but
yeah,
they changed how we see the laws, as you said. So is there a more fundamental change in the system that we need to prevent that from reoccurring? Because at this point, like, it's hard to imagine, like, even if you break up some of these big corporations and their monopolies and so on, like, they're still going to be pretty powerful, just organizations in general. And so I think you're just dealing with tougher competition.
More entrenched competition, because now you can have, you know, Zuckerberg put on like a baggy t-shirt and a chain and go on a couple of podcasts, and you have far more support and sympathy to Zuckerberg than maybe, like, I don't know, like Andrew Carnegie ever had from like the average American.
I don't know how, actually, every poll I've seen is like people really don't like Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, bad example. He's a like uniquely unlikable individual.
And also, you know, Bezos is really not that popular. It's like people kind of like they like hitting the buttons on Amazon, but they don't like Jeff Bezos.
He had a cool wedding though.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Leo DiCaprio came to his wedding. That's something.
Yeah. I mean, the one, you know, the people at Google, you know, it's like I have to say, it's like they're hard to dislike. You know, they're you know, it's just like you see them and you say, those seem nice people. But, you know, most of the other oligarchs are a little hard to take.
Fine. So maybe let's look at something more pertinent to the times, the question of Palantir, right? Mm-hmm. Objectively speaking, sure. You know, Alex Karp goes on stage and talks about, yeah, like we use this technology to wipe out people in war zones. Like, of course, why wouldn't we do that? And largely speaking, there are entire corners of the internet's a bad way to put it, but the junior investors into Palantir, they're cheering it on. Their stocks are going up. Yeah, like deregulate. Because I think more and more of the population is invested in the success of these organizations. That's to Levon's point. I think it's going to be so much harder at this second pass to introduce that kind of regulatory framework when a lot of like popular support kind of exists for these entities that maybe hasn't existed in the past when you talk about like Hearst Publishing or Standard Oil or something like that.
Yeah. Also, everyone's 401ks are like tied to
we're all enmeshed with these companies. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of that. Well, just wait till the next bust, and then we'll rethink that. But it's, here's an important thing to understand is that, rich people kind of, you know, they do act as a group. They do have class interests. They But there's also different levels within among rich people. So, you know, one way to understand, you know, if you go back, say, go back to 1985 and you look at the distribution of power, you know, it's like if you looked at the, you know, the Fortune 500, you know, it's like each of those was incredibly powerful corporations, right? Mm-hmm. But there was actually a broad equality among those 500. And then actually a broad equality among probably the top 2,000 corporations in the United States in terms of their ability to influence governance in the United States. Today, what you see is, you know, there's three or four that five maybe that really stand atop everyone else. Right. So no, you don't have power distributed among 500. You don't have power distributed among 2,000. You have power concentrated in five. So that's a radically different change. And that means that the other 495 don't like the top five. In fact, you mentioned the CARP and you mentioned Palantir. They hate the top five. They're not out there fighting for for the maintenance of power in Facebook. They're not fighting for the maintenance of power in Google. They want those guys would actually, a lot of those, they actually supported a lot of what the antitrust people were doing. They supported it. You know, Rupert Murdoch, you know, the dude is, you know, he's a little bit skits, you know, but he's thinking in two different ways, you know, constantly, but it's like, you know, Rupert Murdoch led a huge amount of the fight this last generation against Google and Facebook. You know, News Corp led that fight. I got calls from Walmart. I've worked with Walmart to fight the other corporations. You know, it's like, so the corporations, they all, remember, it's like there's hierarchies and there's different behaviors among them. And if you go back to like old days, like the House of Lords in England.
The good old days, yeah.
About the House of Lords. Well, what's the purpose of the House of Lords? It's actually all the lords can keep track of each other and make sure none of them gets too uppity. So it's like limited democracy, right? So, so what we see today, do not, you know, it's like we should never forget the degree to which the numbers 6 through 500 in the Fortune 500 hate the top five. Never forget that. So, because that's how you win. That's how you win. Because it's like, and the thing is like, if you break the top five, and you establish rules for going forward, for safe, politically safe competition going forward, these people can continue to get goddamn rich. We ain't against wealth. We ain't against the better ideas. We want what we want. We don't want five trillionaires. We want 5,000 billionaires.
So, okay.
So that might be like, you know, they should pay their taxes too.
Well, yeah, naturally.
I'm with Bernie on this. Like, yeah,
the second we start talking about taxes, all of a sudden, sure, it's not just the top five that are bristling at it. But I want to kind of bring the conversation back to this timeline we were discussing. So we had a blip after 40, 50 years of sort of occult neoliberalism. We had a blip that you described with the Biden administration where some of this more pro-regulatory messaging was introduced, pro-union messaging too. You know, got to give credit to Biden where it's due. Hard to do at times. They totally bungled the election, completely shit the bed. We have the reincarnation, Trump 2.0, MAGA, whatever. And now we're experiencing a complete, it looks like, backlash of business, the big five, whatever you will call it, against that brief moment of regulatory cultural reinvigoration that we experienced. This, in my opinion, is a very interesting time, specifically because we're sort of facing this anti-regulatory culture under Trump, but we can get into that because it's probably not as simple as that. But we're facing that kind of culture with the simultaneous mass introduction to one of the most consequential technologies that our economy's ever faced in the form of AI. So can you set the stage for us, right? What is happening in the Trump administration with regards to antitrust, with regards to regulation? Is it
mimicking anything that was happening under the Biden administration? Is it completely folding to the whims of the Big Five, as you've described them?
Yeah. No, this is good. And actually, just a little bit of just expanding the timeline a little bit. You know, it's like, we don't want to like say Biden is the one who came up with the modern.
Yeah, no, of course.
He voiced it in July.
Yeah, voiced thoughts that were being percolated. Yeah.
But I mean, it's like the person who really broke through, and this was in June 29th, 2016, was Senator Warren. She gave a speech. We hosted the speech. That's why I remember the date. So, and so it was the first modern anti-monopoly speech. Yeah, in the United States, and said the problem, one, we have a monopoly problem that threatens our well-being as consumers, as workers, and as citizens. You know, and big tech is a major part of this, and it's a threat to our democracy. So that's the first modern speech, and that's the speech that actually brought everything together and created a package. That actually was given at a time when the Obama administration was still in power. And there was a bunch of people late in the Obama administration, suddenly, like these people who had been just cruising along on autopilot, on neoliberal autopilot, on laissez-faire autopilot. One day they woke up and they go, oh, my God, there's all these problems that are due to, it looks like, monopoly. So wages are going down and prices are going up and there's all kinds of different controls. So they suddenly freaked out late in, you know, their last year, their last 10 months in power, they freaked out and they started to. So the Obama administration was the first ones to officials to sound the alarm. Warren is the one who really put the idea out there. And then Trump won. You know, was pretty mixed on this, but Trump won was not bad on fighting monopoly. They talked about it a lot. They stole our lines. They used our lines to get votes.
By our, you mean the Open Market Institute?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is not, you know, this didn't start in summer of 2021. It's like this was we spent years developing a analysis and helping people understand the analysis. Helping people wake up from neoliberalism. So this has been going on for a long time. And in terms of where's the Trump administration? This Trump administration started off looking like it was going to continue the approach of Trump won, which was, we actually want to stop the Big Five to a large extent. We want to stop the Big Five and make room for the 495. That was kind of Trump One's approach. It was, they didn't care about people, but they did care about extreme concentration.
Was it because, you know, the top five were more like liberal? Like slanted, you know, and now that they're on there, you know, okay with conservatives, they don't care.
Like, you know what it was? It's like that liberal stuff actually came out kind of later in the process. But what really got Trump on moving was Mr. Rupert Murdoch. Mr. Murdoch said, I am so sick of these people eating my advertising. So it's my advertising. Give it back to me. So,
so that's nothing to do with like woke solid principles,
yeah.
But it's just, you know, again, pure self-interest.
Yeah. Solid principles exist for the people to guide themselves with. Corporations and solid principles exist for the people to understand how to regulate corporations. Going back to this issue of appetite, you know, corporations are, you know, if you don't have a good rule of law, they're going to be driven by the appetite of the worst people in the system. They're just going to want to like exploit and extract and crush and then, you know, put as much, you know, so that their bellies get as fat as possible. You know, that's just human nature, you know, so it's like, yeah, we should not. None of these people at the end of the day are, there's a few people who, you know, I think, you know,
have ethics,
have some ethics, some moral, there's some restraints, some inbuilt restraints, but the corporations don't. Corporations can't. They're just institutions, right? So it's never expect a corporation to have a soul because they ain't people. But this administration, the second administration, rather than sort of restricting the top five, seems to be increasingly saying, well, let's use these biggest corporations to achieve our political ends here in the United States and our political ends elsewhere. So that's it's unfortunate, that there's a big fight that's going on in the Republican Party right now, because between those who actually understand what it means to give yet more control over communications to the big five, and those who, sort of see near-term political benefit from it. So the smart people in the Republican Party understand that this pathway will lead to the end, the complete end of democracy, the complete end of an open society, the complete concentration of power over the individual. So, that's which is one of the jobs that we all have, is actually to drive wedges between the bad people and the people who may not be good, but they do their understanding of their self-interest leads them to oppose concentration of power.
I mean, that being said, Trump did not keep Lena Khan around at FTC. In fact, Trump removed the two Democratic FTC commissioners, basically turning it into an entirely toothless organization. He's completely started staffing agencies like HHS with individuals that are entirely invested in deregulating organizations like the FDA.
Yeah.
The appointment of Jim O'Neill under Bobby Kennedy Jr., I think is pretty telling of that. It seems like everywhere you look, the Trump admin is like sticking somebody like vaguely related to Peter Thiel and that whole ecosystem into a position of power. So it almost seems like that's the culture that has been given life while we're facing down this unique moment in history to regulate or sort of carve out guardrails for AI.
Yeah, yeah. So you just said it. You said it perfectly. This last Trump administration was a very mixed bag. This Trump administration is basically entirely in favor of just ruthless, extra legal, authoritarian, arbitrary exercise of power, at every level. And, it's really the recreation of something that looks like the concentration of power in the individual that we saw under Stalinist Russia. It's not just actually, we're not just returning to where we were at the beginning of the modern era, when liberalism was created in the fight against the all-powerful king, the all-powerful sovereign in the 17th century. That was what that's where liberal democracy comes from, is we're going to protect the liberty of the individual against the authority of the king, of the sovereign, of the monarch. So so one understanding politically, legally, is that that's where we're back to, is that situation. But now you also have these surveillance technologies that put us into the realm of Stalin, into the realm of Mao, into the realm of the PRC, in Beijing. We have people like, some of the oligarchs have actually said, it's like surveillance is good. We need to have control over people. We need to be able to make sure that people never do anything bad. So this is so. Larry Ellison said that publicly. So that's the situation. We're moving towards something that if we don't stop it, we're moving towards something that looks like Stalinism on steroids. And then we have AI, as you mentioned. Then you have AI. So what does AI do? Now, AI is like, we spend a lot of time looking at the physical effects of AI within the form of these giant data centers that are being built, these server farms, and it's like, so the physical effects of AI, which are manifested in the building of these data centers all over the place, and the sucking up of water and the sucking up of electricity, so that these, big five corporations can compete with each other for ultimate mastery. That's like a giant, it's taking a bad situation environmentally and making it vastly worse, Now, at the level of manipulation, what AI is doing is it's making it that much easier for people to use these platforms to manipulate you, to get you to read what they want you to read, to go where they want you to go. You earlier said Google Maps, they give you better predictions. No, they don't. It's like sometimes they do. But actually what they're constantly doing is they're studying how to manipulate you. It's like, Google, what they do is they're a manipulation machine. And sometimes they manipulate you in ways that actually empower you. Usually they manipulate you in ways that hide all kinds of information from you. AI is going to is already radically increasing their ability to manipulate you by allowing them to take the personalization of information, personalization of pricing to an entirely different level. And what they do is like the public. What is the public? Public is a bunch of people who get together in the street and if it's a public requires more or less the same information, same understanding of reality to function as a public. When you give each member of the public different information, when each person sees a different thing, each person lives inside their own little bubble, then the public ceases to exist. You cannot concentrate power as the public to master the power of the oligarchs. You can't, because you don't have a shared knowledge base. You don't have a shared understanding of what reality is. So AI is a reality destruction machine.
And so I want to rephrase a question that I asked earlier that Andre had hijacked.
Yeah.
But okay, so these big corporations have just endless money. They can hire lawyers to find all the loopholes in the law. They change how we see the law and so on. What can we actually do?
Yeah. So what can we do? So people are already doing this. We started doing this. I started doing this more than 20 years ago. My first book, End of the Line, came out in 2005. And that was the first book. It came out this month, 20 years ago, August 2005.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah. So, and that book was the first one that said, hey, within our supply chains, within our international industrial system, there's all this concentration of capacity that makes us, that puts us at risk, because there's like all these chips, these semiconductor manufacturing facilities that are all in Taiwan. And that's not a good place to have all your key semiconductor facilities. Or, it's like there's all these factories that we now depend on that, or it's the only place where something important is made. So this was the beginning of our understanding. The book that I wrote 20 years ago is the beginning of the understanding about the dangers posed by extreme concentration of capacity. And we saw how that played out in the early days of COVID. With all the supply chain crashes, collapses, that was foreseeable. We could see that more than 20 years ago. I wrote a book about it. Everyone talked about it back then, and then they forgot about it. And so, this process of actually then going from that window opening and then sort of saying, oh, let's look at all the other ways in which concentrated power and control is affecting us when it comes to our communications, when it comes to our retail, when it comes to our transportation, when it comes to our healthcare. Let's look at all these different ways in which concentration of power is affecting us. So we've been doing this. We've developed this analysis over the course of 20 plus years now. We didn't actually break through in a major way until 2016. But that's, that's now kind of been 10 years since we broke through. People in the United States, with the exception of half of the Democratic Party, The only people who actually don't understand power are like the elites in the Democratic Party. Everyone else, all the people out in the streets, they understand concentrated power because they live it every day at work. When they go online, when they try to buy something and they get, you know, when they go to buy tickets to see Taylor Swift and they get manipulated or it's a very specific grievance,
yeah, Barry.
Yeah. It's just, so people, everyone feels it every day. All the polls show 80, 85% of the people. What's one of your top, your very top issues? Being manipulated, my lack of sense of liberty, my lack of sense of agency. This is what people feel. In the Republican administration, everyone there, no one believes in neoliberalism in the Republican. They all believe in power. It is brute, open use of power in the Republican administration. The only people who still believe in this nonsense ideology are the elites half the elites in the Democratic Party. So that means, why do I say this? Why is this important? This is important because as we go forward, as we finish this awakening of the Democratic Party, as we get rid of the people who are too corrupt to serve the American people or are too stupid to serve the American people, as we clean the party of the people who are too corrupt or too stupid, then we will find ourselves with an institution that we can use to bust this power, to retake control and bust this power.
How do we remove them? Is the billion-dollar question in this sense? Because I mean, what you're saying makes total sense, but it seems that is the gridlock that we're approaching. So I guess to Levon's question, what can the average American sounds awful. What can the you know, run-of-the-mill average American do to rid the Democratic Party of those elements that are preventing it from being a true force to reinvigorate our constitutional order?
Yeah, actually, it's really simple. It's like so everyone right now says, free me from Trump. That's it. That's that's half the... three-quarters of the Republican Party actually...
There's still a lot of MAGA flags out there, let me tell you, in the countryside.
Let's say, half the Republicans are kind of, are ready to get rid of Trump. And then every Democrat and just about every independent is ready to get rid of Trump. So you got to aim at Trump. The key to controlling the Democratic Party is to insist that is to understand that Trump stands on the backs of oligarchs. He stands on the back of the monopolists. That's how he got power. That's how he exercises power. So the Democratic Party must do two things. It must oppose Trump and it must destroy oligarchy. So when you talk as any member of the Democratic Party, as any independent out there who actually has any influence over anybody in the Democratic Party, it's just, we cannot only be anti-Trump. We have to be fundamentally anti-oligarch. That the party needs to be built to fight oligarchy. We got halfway there. We have to complete that job. We got halfway. We must complete the job. And if we do that, if we walk out there clear of mind, clear of purpose, clear of mission, we win because we actually, what Lina Khan and Jonathan Cantor and Rohit Chopra and all these people in the last administration, what they did is they brought back the old tools and they showed, here's how we use them. They're still here. Stop being stupid.
Do you think...
Don't be stupid and just recognize power and just accept the fact that we actually have... we have proven that we can break power. And we have allies around the world who are working with us on this in Europe and many other places around the world. So we have many friends all around the world and in MAGA who actually ultimately, end of the day, believe in liberal democracy.
But do you think a Democratic candidate could actually win without big corporate donors?
Yes.
Absolutely. We've proven that the power of small money campaigns.
To Levon's point, you did mention that ultimately speaking, the Kamala Harris campaign did fold to the prospect of donor money.
That's why they lost. She gave up the moral high ground. She gave up the moral high ground. She gave up the intellectual high ground for $1 billion, which they wasted on Facebook. And that's why we're in this shit. You know what? So it's like, that was a bad decision. Going forward, if we make the same decision again, that means that we are stupid.
Well, so let's say, you know, Democrats gain control, the type of Democrats that you would like gain control. You said they would just like bust things up. Like what exactly, like concretely would they do? Would they break up the companies? Will they break up Google, Facebook? Like what, or would they pass new law? Like what would they exactly do? Because each case seems kind of unique, and so I'm struggling to know, like,
yeah.
it's a huge, like, thing to try to do, really.
No, there's two parts to this. There's the act of restructuring of corporations, which is, and then there's the prevention of the mergers, the prevention of the deals. You know, one of the things that Jonathan Cantor and Lena Khan achieved is they crushed the deal flow. They crushed it, you know. So by the number of merger deals that were proposed in the last administration was a fraction of what existed before. So they stopped that form of business, and that didn't. That actually is not. It's simply a restriction on one way of getting ahead. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're an executive. And it just says, oh, you know what? You can't take the lazy way out, which is buying your competitor. You're going to have to outcompete them. You're going to bring better ideas, better services, better techniques to market, and you'll do fine. And so that's number one. Number two is actually, as you said, is restructuring the behavior and the actual structure of corporations. And so an example of this is the two cases against Google, against their search monopoly and against their ad tech monopoly, both of which the U.S. government won those cases, and both of which have led to big conversations about what to break off from Google. Now, we don't know what this administration is going to do. Had Biden-Harris won, we would now be talking about an entirely new internet, because we would be shattering Google. The Google that we know, which is really dominates the foundations of the internet, is the Trumpies may still do this. They still may do this. So that was one of the things that was teed up in the 3.5 years when they were actually going after big tech. 3.5 years, and they teed up the entire restructuring of the internet for the next 100 years. Based on new principles. We did it. We did it, and we can do it again. And so, it's not impossible. It's actually eminently possible. We've proven it's possible. And we don't have to go after, it's like, do we need to like break up Walmart? You know, at some point, maybe there's, actions, but it's like the key thing is actually to make sure you have a hierarchy of things that you're targeting. So you don't have to do everything all at once. Keep democracy, keep free speech, free debate, free communications.
What about taxation as like a form of like a capping power, like a progressive tax on corporations where, yeah, they just can't get too big because the taxes just prevent them from making enough profit at a certain point.
People have used that. We've had those tools in the past. Actually, people have even tried that recently with Walmart. But you know, it's like it's hard to pass those kind of laws because of laws against, you know, they're seen as discriminatory behavior by the state. You know, here in Washington D.C., for a while they tried to tax Walmart at a different rate than smaller retailers. You can change the law to do that. It does require changing the law, and it's been done in the past. It's So it's part of a toolkit. It's potentially part of a toolkit. It's not going to be the solution, you know. But the one way to understand anti-monopoly is it's not just anti-monopoly is everything you use to promote the distribution of power and opportunity and control, you know, and to neutralize what you can't distribute. So it's not just antitrust. It's not just common carrier principles. It's taxation. Procurement law. It's like all these things form a package. And what we used to do in America is you had everything was aimed at preventing concentration. So we have an entire model system, political economic system that worked for more than 200 years. It's just sitting there. And we partly started to bring it back. There was a major effort to bring it back in the last administration. And the only reason we're not like going full steam ahead on that project right now is because Joe Biden and Kamala Harris didn't know how to talk about their own victories. They didn't know how to talk about what they had achieved.
I mean, you could say they didn't know how to talk, period.
Yeah,
at this point. I mean, it was it's bad.
Yeah. So here, heroes who, you know, there were other things that, you know, it's like the fact that we, so many people in the party continued to believe the neoliberal philosophy meant that there was an inability of people gave a lot of energy in the last administration. They gave a lot of space to people like Larry Summers in the debate, to people like Jason Furman in the debate. Like, you know, the New York Times, they were constantly quoting Larry Summers and Jason Furman, who are arch neoliberals. They're the ones that got us into this problem. You know, Ezra Klein. I mean, Ezra Klein is an arch neoliberal. It's just like the dude, he doesn't understand power.
Abundance.
he has no understanding of power. The guy walks around, it's just like that whole part of his brain is missing. You know, and it's like, and so we, you know, when you have a party in which, you know, you just keep putting up people who were actually the liars who got us into this problem, or people who are walking around, you know, completely blind to power. And these are the people we turn to for guidance. Well, we deserve every goddamn thing we get. But that was, you know, so it wasn't just their failure to talk. It was also our failure, the resistance among many Democrats to listen, to understand.
Is it too late to start listening? I mean, do you think that with the rapid kind of destruction of the American civil service under the current administration, mm-hmm. is there going to be any sort of like appetite or even instrument for regulatory law to come into, or anti-monopoly laws, you phrase, to come into frame in whatever administration comes after Trump 2.0.
Yeah, you know, in the 19 late 30s, during the New Deal, the first 4 years of the New Deal was essentially anti-monopoly was part of it, but it wasn't a major part. And then in the around 1936, FDR and his people said, you know what? Actually, we've been not using the most important law, which is anti-monopoly, the most important suite of laws. So they, and the second New Deal began in 1936, 37. And that was the sort of a much more radical use of anti-monopoly. And so one of the things they did, you could actually see this in the DOJ, they had like 90 lawyers working on antitrust at the DOJ in like 1937. They went up to 650 within like 2 years, you know. So, there's a vast, this is America. It's like there's 330 plus million people here. It's like we have a fantastic body of knowledge and wealth of knowledge among the people of the United States, we could just gather the people into the room again. You know, it's so they got fired. You know, it's like, but it's just the ideas. You can't destroy the ideas. You can destroy you can break an office, but you can't destroy the ideas that that office existed to promote.
It is harder to rebuild something than to destroy it, especially if all of them, all the civil servants that have been let go end up going to work for Palantir, drawing like five times their original salary. It's,
you know, the thing is that so many people actually, if the choice is between apocalypse and, you know, taking a smaller salary, a lot of people will choose like, I don't need the, $1 million salary. I'll accept, $220 and be a lawyer for the government. So, and make the and ensure that my kids have a world to live in, you know? So it's like, there's a lot to be said for having a world that we can live in. And so, and I think there's a, I would say that 90, this is, you know, it's like, you know, we look at this situation and we say, oh, it's impossible to fix. It's like, you know, in 1941, it's like, you know, we have to go fight. We have to go destroy the Nazis in Europe, and we have to destroy the militarists in Japan. Gosh, that's a big task. So, but then, you know, you go out and you figure out how to do it. A secession of the South in the Civil War. It's like, oh my God, it's like early 1862. How are we going to rebuild America? You know, people went out and they figured out how to do it, and people died in those fights. Lots of people sacrificed themselves. So the thing is, like, if we're saying that actually the American people, that we are at a point where we can't get a few thousand people to sacrifice their $1 million salaries to save democracy and ensure and fix climate change, then yeah, it's over. I actually think that we have. I think that there's a given the right. If we provide the right environment, we will be the there will be 10 people for every job, fighting to do this. It's like, people want to fight to make the world better. This is what we have done so many times, and it's this sad sort of demoralization of the of Democrats that that's the only enemy, is the fact that we all, we've basically lost hope.
It's true that people want to fight to make the world a better place. However, every episode of this podcast, we talk about how there's a disproportionate number of sociopaths in positions of power, politicians, CEOs, etc. What's your intuition from working with politicians, adjacent to politicians? Like, what sense do you have?
Well, you know, that's what the Constitution was framed out in the 1780s. Americans framed out the Constitution in the 1780s to control sociopaths. That's what constitutional government is sociopathic control. You know, so. So what is anti-monopoly? Anti-monopoly is the extension of constitutional structures into the political economy. So just so we understand what anti-monopoly is. So why do we have a constitutional crisis in the United States right now? It's because we stopped promoting distribution of power, checks and balances in the political economy. Mm-hmm. So there's extreme concentration, and now that power is coming back into the political system and destroying our political democracy. So this is all predictable. People, 250 years ago understood this. There's always been sociopaths, in human society, we did a pretty good job over, for more than 200 years in protecting ourselves against them. There's lots of sociopaths out there. But again, this actually goes back to what we were saying at the beginning about appetite. structure limits, by creating structures that limit your ability to exercise your gross appetites, your sociopathic appetites for power and other things, it pushes you towards more moral and ethical action. You know, so it's like this is so the thing about sociopaths. You end up with the more caste there is, the more sociopaths you are. You know, and so this is an easy to fix problem. It's just like rule of law. Traditional rule of law is anti-sociopath. It's a system of for crushing sociopathy.
I don't know if easy to fix is the right way to frame it, but I'm glad you have that optimism. I think
it's refreshing to have some optimism.
It's like Elon. Why did we go from like merely crazy Elon to like bad Elon? How did that happen?
Perhaps he was always bad. Perhaps there
He was always bad, but it's like, that was in him, but it couldn't get out, right? So are there days when I don't know. Does he wake up certain days and go, I wish they didn't let this out. You know, the spirit that was hidden inside of me. I don't know. You know, maybe he's got moments of reflection, you know.
I think deep into the ketamine usage is probably where the...
if you watch Shakespeare, right? So Shakespeare's filled with sociopaths, you know, who in the darkness when they're wandering in their bedrooms at night and they can't sleep and they go, I wish I wasn't a sociopath. So it's...
we'll be sympathizing for Elon Musk, right? You know, the poor fellow.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like he could be. Why did you know? It's like I think he wants to be loved. Most people ultimately would prefer to be loved than hated, and so you know, I think he sometimes. I'm guessing maybe some days he wakes up and he goes, "Yeah, maybe the other pathway. You know, I'd still be loved."
This all of a sudden turned into a Lex Friedman show.
Yeah. This is one of the things that we should understand about systems of checks and balances of rule of law is a way to create a moral economy. And people really understood it as a way to create a moral economy. This is a way to limit immoral behavior. You know, it's like you put limits on behavior that we regard as immoral. And so if it's law, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not monopolize, you know. So we regard these, you put limits on behaviors that you regard as immoral. But also in doing that, you actually, the other thing is you create the opportunity for the individual and society as a whole to engage in moral growth. You know, if you're not out there being governed by your appetite, by your need to compete, by your need to fight, by your need to dominate other people, then other parts of your soul are able to, you know, you're able to develop other parts of your soul. Other parts of who you are, you know. So some people maybe they're just born the way they are, but a lot of people are born complex. Most people are born complex. You have many potential pathways that you can walk, and with a smart rule of law, a smart system of law that limits your ability to exercise power over other people, then you can actually. Both as individuals and as a community begin to say, you know what? We can actually live in better ways. I can be a better person. I can, you know, and then we can make better communities. So it's like, this is, and so we should never, you know, it's like the aim here is not simply to break the power of the autocrats. It's not simply to break the power of Trump and the oligarchs. It's like we always have to remember where we're going on the other side of these threats, and where we're going is a world that could be is really materially a better place, mm-hmm. and it's also a morally better place, mm-hmm. in which we have spend our lives in ways that are perhaps much more truly satisfying and empowering than, you know, simply like running a corporation in which I celebrate my ability to pick the pockets of my employees. It's like, that's a sad life.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. I think I would say that we take a win that we have a positive note to end an episode on versus our normal like doom and gloom projections. So thank you for that, Barry.
I do think, I mean, this is, and the key thing is like, we are going to win. We are going to win. And it's like, this is the worst moment. This is the moment in which everyone is terrified. This is the moment in which, you know, people are entirely disillusioned and demoralized. This is the moment when, you know, our army was beaten in the field and we were hiding in the trees. You know, we're hiding in the forest, you know, and everybody is behind a different tree and we don't, you know, it's like there's no community, there's no sense of common purpose at the present. You know, we're all like scrambling with each other for like, you know, over roots and bark and grubs. You know, and it's like this is a bad time for people who believe in liberal democracy. But the thing about it is the people we're fighting are incompetent. They're crazy. And it's like as soon as we form our ranks, as soon as we get back on our, you know, it's like, you know, just pick ourselves up, clean ourselves off, march forward, clean our ranks of the corrupt and the idiot, and we, you know, we win.
We'll it's call like, that your fight on the beaches speech.
Yeah. So this is 20 years from now, 10 years from now, we're going to look back at this moment and we will, you know, I am confident that people who believe in liberal democracy will say this was the moment in which we actually fixed everything that we had let go wrong since the beginning of the neoliberal experiment 40 years ago.
I think it would be worth to revisit that. And it does feel like we're in a pivotal moment. It does feel like this is kind of a point of transition. Jury's out on which direction we'll head to, but I want to believe that things will get better. Barry, if listeners want to access your work, the work of the Open Markets Institute, where can they find it? What is the best way they can kind of stay in touch with this research and analysis being done on anti-monopoly policy?
So we have a very, you know, a very robust website, you know, which talks about it. So there's Open Markets Institute, we have about 20, 22 people, you know, how you count, 25 people who are part of our team. We have a great network of friends all around the world. You know, we operate in Europe. We operate across the United States. We operate in all these different sectors. So there's a vast array of a vast wealth of ideas and reporting and proposals that we have. And it's all, you know, you can find it on our openmarketsinstitute.org. And there's ways to sign up for our newsletters. We're out there. You search us and we're easy to find. And there's really a lot of material that we've developed and wins. We got a whole, you know, there's so many wins that we already have. Which is what allows us to know that we're going to have so many wins in the future.
We're going to keep winning, folks. We're going to keep winning. Yeah. We'll get so tired of the winning that we do, or whatever the quote is from POTUS. Thank you, Barry. It was a real pleasure to have you on. Thank you for spending some time with us and giving us something to hopefully be hopeful about.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to talk to you guys.